Welcome to ISM. This is a bonus episode for 20th Century Revolutions on nationalism and the spark of World War I. Ideas meet power. Prologue. The Bells of Wiedoften. June the 28th, 1914. The patience of Archduke Franz Ferdinand was wearing thin. The mayor's words rolled over him in their stiff, rehearsed politeness. The man looked nervous, his red fez slipping slightly to one side as sweat traced down a carefully waxed mustache, now beginning to sag. He read from his paper in a trembling voice. "Your Highness, our hearts are filled with joy at your visit." Franz's jaw tightened. He could not bear it any longer. "Filled with joy," he snapped. "One comes here for a visit and is greeted with bombs. Mr. Mayor, it is outrageous." The room froze. Behind him, aides shifted uncomfortably. Sophie's hand found his wrist, gentle yet firm. She leaned in and whispered something only he could hear. "Very well," he said quietly. "Now you may speak." The mayor stumbled through the rest of his address. "Your visit, Your Highness, is proof of our unbreakable loyalty." But Franz no longer heard him. Outside, he knew soldiers were still scrubbing blood from the cobblestones, their rags turning pink in the river water. Smoke still hung over the Milyaka. He leaned toward one of his officers. "We will visit the wounded," he murmured. The man hesitated, eyes lowered. Sophie's hand tightened around his arm. Franz smiled reassuringly. "They will see," he said, straightening, "that the monarchy is not the enemy." After the ceremony, Franz passed his blood-stained parchment to his valet. The imperial retinue filled outside into the white glare of noon. Somewhere beyond the city walls, he noticed church bells were ringing. Franz frowned. "Why the bells?" he asked. The mayor hesitated, wiping his brow with a shaking hand. "It is St. Vitus Day, Your Highness. The Serbs commemorate the martyrs of Kosovo from the battle long ago." Franz tilted his head. "I see. But of course," the mayor added hastily, "they do not represent the majority here. The city stands with you, Your Highness." The Archduke lingered for a moment, puzzled by this last remark, then nodded. "Very well, let us see the wounded. We must not let a few radicals stand in our way." A valet opened the door to their convertible, and the royal couple climbed in. The driver, flustered, started the engine, and the motorcade pulled out into the blistering heat. Behind them, the bells of Wiedoften continued to toll. Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to ISM. This is Sarajevo 1914, the assassin, the archduke, and nationalism's crucible. Hi, everyone, and welcome to this special ISM bonus episode, released especially for those of you who have been with me through the first two seasons of 20th Century Revolutions. I cannot thank you enough for your support, and I'm thrilled to finally share this new project with you. So, alongside this episode, the first three episodes of ISM have officially dropped. Season 1 takes us into the birth of socialism in revolutionary Paris, while weaving in the great ideological debates that shaped the 19th century left. Reform versus revolution, liberty versus equality, Marxism versus anarchism. You can find a link to the podcast in the show notes, along with a link to the ISM Substack. And Substack is where the show will really live, with transcripts, recommended readings, and behind-the-scenes pieces, where I'll take you deeper into my research and creative process for these little immersive scenes. I hope you'll join me there and continue this journey as we build something new together. And with that, we now return to Sarajevo, 1914. On June the 28th, 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and his wife, Sophie, were shot and killed in the streets of Sarajevo by the Bosnian Serb revolutionary, Gavrilo Princip. This assassination would set off a cascade of events during the July Crisis, and by August, nearly all of Europe's great powers would be at war. And through their vast imperial networks, they would drag half the world with them into an inferno that would fundamentally transform every corner of the globe. In the decades that followed, the terrible carnage of the First World War and the wave of revolutions it unleashed would overshadow the spark that first lit the fuse in Sarajevo. But when we return to that moment, we find a truth that still resonates today. That at the heart of both the assassination and the war it sparked was a clash of ideas. Between ethnic nationalism and imperial pluralism. Between old empires and rising nation-states. World War I not only claimed millions of lives, it also completely reordered the world. Ancient multi-ethnic empires, the Austrian, Ottoman, Russian, and German, collapsed. In their place emerged new nation-states, many built explicitly on ethnic lines. Czechoslovakia, Poland, Finland, Turkey, Germany, Austria, Estonia, Yugoslavia, and so on. And nowhere better captures the upheaval of this transformation than the region where it all began, the Balkans. For centuries, the Balkans had been the meeting point of competing empires, Austrian, Ottoman, Russian, and the region was layered with a dizzying mosaic of peoples, faiths, and allegiances. But by the early 20th century, a new idea had taken hold in the Balkans. The idea that a people made a nation and that nations deserved their own states. What began in Serbia, Bulgaria, Greece, and Bosnia would, after the war, echo outward across the ruins of Europe's crumbling imperial order. Because even beyond Europe, the combined collapse of empires and the rhetoric of Wilsonian self-determination would inspire national movements in the Middle East, India, Korea, and China, even if independence would come later or unevenly. But in the Balkans, those contradictions had already been playing out for decades. Dreams of unity colliding with ethnic violence. Imperial collapse giving way to fragile new borders. Gavrilo Princip himself was a Serbian nationalist who dreamed of a united South Slav state, Yugoslavia. And ironically, the war he helped ignite would bring that dream closer to reality. By 1918, the Kingdom of Yugoslavia was formed out of the ashes of the Austrian and Ottoman empires, with its capital in Belgrade, the furnace of Serbian nationalism. What held this new kingdom together was not so much a monarch, but an idea that the South Slavs shared a common destiny, forged through blood, language, and history. And so, even though the conspirators were imprisoned or executed, and even though the creation of Yugoslavia would prove violent and chaotic, the war ultimately fulfilled their vision of national liberation. And that is why, when Gavrilo Princip raised his pistol and aimed it at the Archduke, this was not just an act of political violence. It was an ideological confrontation. Two irreconcilable worldviews stood face-to-face in Sarajevo, the plural multi-ethnic empire and the exclusive nationalist ideal. In a very real sense, the gunfire in Sarajevo was the sound of the old world dying, as a new, more dangerous world was being born. Chapter 1. The Balkan Inferno. The political union of the Yugoslavs was always before my eyes, and that was my basic idea. I am a Yugoslav nationalist, aiming for the unification of all Yugoslavs, and I do not care what form of the state, but it must be free from Austria. Gavrilo Princip in his trial testimony, 1914. Going into 1914, the year that would plunge the world into the Great War, the Balkans, where that war would begin, had already been utterly transformed. Sitting at the crossroads of three great empires, the Austrian, Russian, and Ottoman, the region had always been volatile, a frontier of many competing faiths and diverse peoples. But in the years just before the war, the old pattern of great power imperial rivalries had given way to something even more explosive, the birth of new nation-states. For centuries, conflict in the Balkans had followed a fairly familiar pattern. Large empires would clash, local peoples would seize the moment to demand autonomy, and when the great powers settled their treaties, the Balkans would then return to an ever uneasy peace. Yet as the Ottoman Empire receded and the map was redrawn, the logic of empire was gradually replaced by the logic of the nation. In the wake of the Young Turk Revolution and the Bosnian Crisis of 1908, a cluster of small nation-states had emerged. Bulgaria, Romania, Montenegro, Greece, and most ambitiously, Serbia. Each carried its own story of liberation, but together they represented something new in modern Europe, a region where every border had been drawn not by dynastic decree, but by a belief, by the conviction that people made up a nation and that nations were worth dying for. Each of these new states carried its own national mythscape. Stories of birth and rebirth, of golden ages restored, of wounds that had never healed. Some of these myths were true, others half-true, and many deliberately fashioned to legitimize their borders, whether those borders already existed on the maps or only in distant fantasies. And because these stories quite often overlapped, so too did the territorial claims. Romania and the Dobrija, Bulgaria and Thrace, Greece and Yanina, Serbia and Kosovo, and everyone, absolutely everyone, claimed Macedonia. Among the most contested of these lands was Bosnia, with its ancient crossroads capital of Sarajevo. Like nearly all of the Balkans, tiny Montenegro being the lone exception, Bosnia had been under Ottoman rule for almost five centuries. But the old imperial balance began to crumble in 1908, when a secret cell of reformist officers in the Macedonian city of Salonika rose up in the Young Turk Revolution. The revolt of the Committee of Union and Progress sent shockwaves through the Balkans. It challenged the complacency of the great powers, threatened the fragile arrangements brokered by Russia and Great Britain, and emboldened the rising nationalist movements. And so, the Young Turk Revolution would set off a chain of escalations, annexations, crises, and two brutal Balkan wars that would eventually carry the region, step by step, toward the summer of 1914. Since winning their independence from or autonomy within the Ottoman Empire, the Balkan states had waged a long, informal campaign against their former imperial master. Through networks of guerrilla bands, schoolteachers, priests, and political agitators, each state sought to extend its influence into lands still under Ottoman control, above all Macedonia and Thrace, the battleground of what became known as the Macedonian struggle. And in this fight to win the hearts and minds of those still living under Ottoman rule, violence often erupted not only against Ottoman authorities, but between the Balkan states themselves. But then, in the fall of 1912, Montenegro, Bulgaria, Serbia, and Greece did something unprecedented. They formed the Balkan League and declared war on the Ottoman Empire together. For the first time, the emerging nation-states of the peninsula acted as a united front. The result was catastrophic for the Ottomans and euphoric for the Balkan states. To many observers, both within the Balkans and beyond, the Balkan Wars looked like the dawn of a new age. Here, at last, was the triumph of the ethnic nation-state over the old multi-ethnic empires. The Christian peoples of the Balkans reclaiming their ancestral lands after centuries of foreign rule. But the reality on the ground was far darker. The defining feature of the conflict was an unprecedented wave of atrocities, especially against Muslims in former Ottoman Europe. The armies of Serbia, Greece, and Bulgaria saw their campaign as both a moment of vengeance for centuries of Ottoman domination and a world historic struggle for national rebirth. Those beliefs, heroic, righteous, and absolute, fueled massacres and reprisals that foreshadowed the worst horrors of the 20th century. The bitterness left by the two Balkan Wars would smolder for generations. None of the combatants fully accepted the borders drawn afterward, each believing its own national aspirations had been thwarted or betrayed. Bosnia-Herzegovina, however, did not change hands in these wars. Claimed from the Ottomans by Austria-Hungary during the Bosnian crisis of 1908, it remained under Habsburg rule. But Serbia had long sought control over Bosnia, and many Bosnian Serbs had agitated for unification with Serbia for nearly half a century, through revolts, uprisings, and wars against the Ottomans. Serbia would emerge from the Balkan Wars as one of the great victors, expanding into northern Macedonia, Albania, and the long-contested Sanjak of Novi Pazar. But no territorial gain inflamed national pride more than the recovery of Kosovo. The conquest of Kosovo was viewed by many Serbs as the final triumph of a centuries-long struggle, and to understand why, we need to wind the clock back a good bit. In 1389, the expanding Ottoman Empire had clashed with a medieval Serbian principality ruled by one Prince Lazar. The decisive battle of the conflict unfolded on the fields of Kosovo, a moment that, in Serbian memory, became far more than a military defeat. According to legend, a Serbian knight named Miloš Obilić slipped behind Ottoman lines, entered the tent of Sultan Murad I, and assassinated the Ottoman sovereign. Captured soon after, Miloš was killed on the spot, while the Ottoman army regrouped and ultimately prevailed. Prince Lazar himself was taken prisoner and executed. Historically, the battle ended in stalemate and mutual devastation. But in the centuries that followed, the myth would outgrow the actual event. Kosovo became a national epic, a story in which the Serbs, under Prince Lazar, had chosen what they called a heavenly kingdom over an earthly one. In this telling, Kosovo was not merely lost territory, but a sacred wound, proof of a nation sanctified through sacrifice. Through poems, church liturgies, and folk songs, generations of Serbs inherited a narrative that wove martyrdom, heroism, and resurrection into a single destiny. By the 19th century, as nationalism was sweeping across Europe, Kosovo had become the beating heart of Serbian identity, the place where the nation was born, died, and was destined to rise again. So, when Serbia reconquered Kosovo after the Balkan Wars, it was hailed as a moment of spiritual redemption, the apparent fulfillment of a 600-year-old promise. Yet this rebirth came at a terrible cost. In Kosovo and throughout Serbia's newly conquered territories, large populations of Muslims, Albanians, Turks, Bosniaks, were massacred and driven from their homes in the thousands. Then, after the war, those Muslims who remained found themselves under a Christian national state that framed its triumph as divine and historical vindication. The Kosovo epic, once a story of suffering, was now wielded as a story of glorious return and rightful dominion. In the heady atmosphere of post-war triumph, a powerful conviction took hold among Serbia's political elite. For if Kosovo had been restored, then Bosnia, with its large Serbian population, must be next. And it was this belief, born of myth and sharpened by victory, that set Serbia and Austria-Hungary on a collision course. And so it is here, in this world of mythic destiny and national resurrection, that we find the ideological roots of the 1914 assassination. June the 28th, the day Archduke Franz Ferdinand made his fateful tour through Sarajevo, was also Vidovdan, St. Vitus Day, the holiest day in the Serbian calendar. Vidovdan commemorates the martyrs of the Battle of Kosovo, Prince Lazar, Miloš Obilić, and all who died beside them. So the date of the assassination was no coincidence. It was chosen deliberately by the young Serbian conspirators, who saw the Archduke's presence in Bosnia as both an insult and an omen. On Vidovdan, they believed the past and present had converged. The martyrs of Kosovo had chosen sacrifice over submission, and now it was their turn to do the same. In the heat of that summer morning, six young men resolved to throw away their own lives for the nation they believed had waited six centuries for redemption. Interlude, The Martyr's Path. The earthly kingdom is short-lived, but the heavenly kingdom endures forever. The Kosovo Cycle, Prophecy of Prince Lazar. Gavrilo Princip stood above the glittering Miljaka River, squinting against the sun as he waited for the motorcade. When the convoy finally appeared, he stiffened. The Archduke and his wife were riding in an open convertible with almost no protective detail, waving calmly to the crowd. A strange mix of emotions washed over him. First, relief. The task might be easier than they feared, but also a flicker of regret. If the Archduke was this exposed, then surely it would be Mehmed Basic who struck first, and would become Serbia's next holy martyr. Princip tightened his grip on the small glass vial in his pocket. The cyanide rattled faintly as he rolled it between his fingers. He braced himself for an explosion. Mehmed Basic was just ahead. Everyone knew him as the oldest, the most severe, the most prepared to die for liberation. But nothing happened. the car drifted past. No bomb, no gunshot. Just the sound of hoofbeats on cobblestone. The light toll of bells in the distance. Princip blinked in disbelief. Mehmed Basic, who had once spoken to them at the grave of Bogdan Zeraich, urging them to follow the lineage of martyrs stretching back to Lazar and Obilich, had frozen. A moment later, Koblilovich also failed to move. Princip's heart hammered. Perhaps he would be the next martyr. Perhaps the day's destiny was his after all. But then, up ahead, he finally saw movement. Kobrinovich raised his arm. Gavrilo exhaled sharply, gripping the bridge railing as the bomb arced through the air. Then it struck the side of the Archduke's car with a hollow clang, bounced off the folded convertible roof, and exploded violently beneath the next vehicle. The street vanished in smoke and shrapnel. Princip coughed, eyes watering, straining to see through the haze. He heard screams, the whinny of horses, the clatter of boots. And then he saw Kobrinovich fling himself over the bridge railing, plunging toward the river below. A moment of stunned stillness followed. Smoke drifted over the river, the smell of powder sharp in the heat. Princip felt his stomach drop as the Archduke's car emerged from the haze and sped toward the town hall. Their chance, the moment they had dreamed of, prayed over, longed for, was gone. He gripped the railing, his throat tightening. As the motorcade disappeared into the distance, Princip pulled his coat tight around himself, the worn fabric clinging to his thin, emaciated frame. Below the bridge, he saw Kobrinovich, having apparently survived both the poison and the fall, being dragged from the water by an enraged crowd and flung onto the stones like a broken doll. Princip watched the scene a moment longer, eyes stinging from smoke and shame, before he forced himself to turn away. Not knowing what remained of the day's purpose, he began walking along the riverbank, following the familiar path toward Schiller's Cafe. Chapter 2. The Furnace of Belgrade. Serbia must not remain within her present borders. The first duty of our policy is the unity of the Serbian nation. Wherever Serbian graves lie, there is Serbia. Ilija Garašanin, Načerdani, 1844. At the turn of the century, Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, was a city shaped by conspiracy, revolution, and a lingering sense of unfinished destiny. Perched at the confluence of the Danube and Sava rivers, it had for centuries been a frontier city, a place where great empires collided and rebellions often formed. After the fall of Constantinople to the Ottomans in 1453, Sultan Mehmed II had laid siege to Belgrade, but the combined Serbian-Hungarian defense held him off for decades. So only in 1521 did Suleiman the Magnificent finally conquer the city, ushering in nearly 300 years of Ottoman rule. In the early 19th century, Belgrade became the headquarters of the Serbian Revolution, first under Karađorđe Petrović and then under Miloš Obrenović. These twin uprisings won Serbia autonomy by mid-century and helped forge a new national mythology centered on liberation, martyrdom, and historical destiny. But the fact that the revolution had been led in two phases by two rival figures also created two competing dynasties. Throughout the 19th century, the Karađorđević and Obrenović houses battled for power, overthrowing, exiling, or assassinating one another in a series of coups and counter-coups. In this volatile political culture, where monarchs were constantly at risk of being overthrown and history was invoked as ideology, conspiratorial networks thrived. By the 1890s and early 1900s, Belgrade was thick with clandestine groups, most prominently Narodna Odbrana, the Serbian Defense, and later Ujedinjenje ili Smrt, Unification or Death, better known as the Black Hand. These organizations fused nationalism, mysticism, and political violence into a worldview that saw Serbia's borders not as legal lines on a map, but as moral imperatives. Schools, army barracks, taverns, and cafes became breeding grounds for young radicals, who believed that they were the heirs to Prince Lazar and Miloš Obilić, the martyrs of Kosovo. Teachers, priests, and military officers spoke openly of an unfinished national mission, the unification of all Serbs in a single state, Greater Serbia. Others dreamed even bigger, of a Yugoslavia, a South Slav homeland stretching across Bosnia and Herzegovina, Dalmatia, and Macedonia. Belgrade was the nerve center of this movement. Teeming with radicalized students, hyper-nationalist military officers, and irredentist guerrilla networks, the city became a swirling nexus of conspiracy, a place where political violence was debated as readily as theology or poetry. In this atmosphere of conspiratorial nationalism, assassination would come to be seen not simply as a political tactic, but as a national tradition. Serbia's modern revolution had been born through political violence. Its founding myths, from Kosovo to the Serbian Revolution, glorified martyrdom and celebrated sacrifice. And now a new generation believed these same tools were necessary to complete the nation. By the end of the 19th century, the Obrenović dynasty had returned to power, but its last ruler, King Alexander I, had become increasingly unpopular. His marriage to Draga Mašin, a former lady-in-waiting, scandalized the court and alienated the public. His disregard for constitutional norms, political repression, and warm relations with Austria-Hungary, Serbia's chief rival in the Balkans and widely seen as the primary obstacle to Serbian expansion, enraged both civilian and military factions. And so, in the early hours of June the 11th, 1903, these tensions reached their breaking point. A circle of radical young officers, led by a shadowy intelligence chief known simply as Apis, formed the core of a conspiracy that resolved to remove the king and queen by force. The resulting May coup would remake Serbian politics, usher in an era of militarized nationalism, and forge the ideological world in which Gavrilo Princip would come of age. Interlude. Unification or death. Belgrade, 1903. I shall execute its orders unquestioningly, and if I should ever violate this oath, may I die by my own hand. The Black Hand Initiation Oath, 1911. Lightning cracked over Belgrade as a column of officers moved through the rain-soaked streets toward the Stari Dvor Palace. They walked with deliberate calm, as though the night itself belonged to them. At their head was Apis, his bald skull shining under the storm light, his thick mustache dripping with rain. As they approached the palace gates, the sentry stepped forward. For one suspended moment, neither man spoke. But then the guard gave a subtle nod and unlocked the gate. The officers slipped inside. At the palace steps, a young conspirator knelt, undid a small oilcloth bundle, and revealed a stick of dynamite. He lit the fuse and hurled it at the front door. A deafening blast tore through the facade, glass, stone, and smoke exploding outward. The palace lights snapped out instantly, plunging the interior into total darkness. The conspirators fanned into the building. Shouts echoed, boots pounded on marble, gunshots cracked in distant rooms. Moments later, two officers emerged from a corridor carrying Apis himself, blood spreading across his tunic where he had been shot in the confusion, possibly by his own men. He waved them off, insisting the operation continue. Farther inside, another team reached the royal apartments. They set a second charge. The blast blew the bedroom doors from their hinges. Soldiers stormed in, ripping down curtains, overturning furniture, shouting curses into the dark. Queen Draga trembled in her nightgown as the sound of splintering wood echoed down the corridor. King Alexander, in his bathrobe, peered through a peephole carved into the paneling of a concealed chamber in Draga's wardrobe. The first explosion had jolted them awake. When the electricity died, they fled to the secret space they had always hoped they would never need. Inside their narrow hiding place, stifling candlelit and close, they could hear the men searching for them. The storm of sound drew closer by the minute. Paneling ripped from the walls, furniture hurled out of windows, drunken shouts, the crack of gunshots echoing through the dark. The search dragged on for hours. Huddled in the secret space, Draga allowed herself a trembling hope. If they could just make it to morning, perhaps the officers would give up and leave. Then came a sharp voice from the bedroom. Here! They're here! The cupboard was torn aside. The officers had found the hollow behind it. Knowing the moment had come, King Alexander forced a steadiness he did not feel. Officers, he said, can you confirm your loyalty? A few terse grunts answered him. neither respectful nor defiant, simply matter of fact. Alexander looked at Draga and gave a slow, resigned nod. The royal couple stepped out into the bedroom, still dressed in their nightclothes. One of the conspirators, a broad-shouldered officer with a heavy beard, raised a revolver. Draga threw herself toward Alexander, but too late. The officer fired several shots into the king's chest. Alexander collapsed at once. A second officer, lean and expressionless, stepped forward with clinical calm. He drove his bayonet repeatedly into Draga's back as she fell beside her husband, the carpet darkening beneath her. What followed was butchery. The officers stabbed and slashed the bodies to disfigure them beyond recognition, a symbolic annihilation of the dynasty they despised. When they were finished, the corpses were dragged to the window and heaved out of the window into the palace garden below, landing in the damp refuse behind the stables. The conspirators stood for a moment at the shattered window. The bearded man holstered his pistol. The slender officer wiped his blade clean with a handkerchief. And then, without ceremony or triumph, they turned back into the darkened palace and carried on with the night's work. The May coup of 1903, in which King Alexander Obrenovich and Queen Draga were murdered by a cabal of hyper-nationalist officers, fundamentally remade Serbian politics. Within hours, Peter Karađorđević was proclaimed king, and the Obrenovich line disappeared from Serbian life. Domestically, the newly crowned King Peter quickly became a pawn of the officers who had placed him on the throne. In the months that followed, the conspirators, with Apis at their center, accumulated enormous influence in the army, the intelligence services, and even in the schools. From a foreign policy standpoint, the crowning of King Peter marked a decisive break in Serbia's relationship with Austria-Hungary. Most Serbian politicians, officers, and ordinary citizens despised the Habsburg Empire and viewed it as the chief obstacle to Serbian national renewal. But King Alexander, and the Obrenovich dynasty more broadly, had accepted that Serbia was economically dependent on the dual monarchy, and therefore had to maintain a deferential, almost conciliatory posture toward Vienna. For Apis and the other conspirators, this posture was intolerable. They believed that only a monarchy openly hostile to Austria-Hungary could secure Serbia's ambitions in Bosnia and Herzegovina and advance the broader project of South Slav unification. With King Peter's ascension, this confrontational stance toward Vienna quickly surged to the center of Serbian political life. And so, a long simmering tension finally erupted into the open. The struggle between the civilian government led by Prime Minister Nikola Pašić, wily and slow-moving architect of Serbian diplomacy, and the hyper-nationalist officers whose networks of radical students and irredentist guerrilla bands now stretched across the Balkans. This conflict between the civilian politicians and the military cabal who assassinated the king and queen is revealing, not only for what divided the two camps, but also for what they had in common. Because both Nikola Pašić and the officer conspirators under Apis both agreed on the core objectives of Serbian politics: national expansion, the unification of the South Slavs, and the weakening, if not eventual dismantling, of Austro-Hungarian influence in the region. This was the near universal consensus in Serbia in the early 20th century. So what separated them was not the goal, but the method. The seasoned politician Nikola Pašić believed that Serbia's aspirations could only be realized through diplomacy, careful timing, and a state-directed strategy that avoided provoking Austria prematurely. Apis and the officer corps believed the opposite, that history moved through decisive action, clandestine networks, and spectacular acts of political violence, and that Serbia had to seize every opportunity to destabilize its enemies. In short, Pašić wanted nationalism to be controlled by the state, while Apis wanted the state to be controlled by nationalism. In reality, these worlds were never fully separate. They overlapped constantly within the conspiratorial close-knit world of Belgrade. Public officials like Pašić often placed informants inside secret organizations, while officers quietly joined these same groups as full members. Factions mixed freely in the city's cafes, smoky rooms where young radicals, military men, teachers, priests, and journalists boasted openly about clandestine missions, cross-border raids, and plots that blurred the line between patriotism and terrorism. Many officers began their careers in the Macedonian struggle, the informal war of guerrilla bands fighting Ottoman authority in Macedonia. Appas himself never served as a frontline Chetnik fighter, but from his earliest years in military intelligence, he worked hand in glove with those guerrilla units, smuggling weapons, arranging safe houses, coordinating infiltrations, and managing the covert networks that kept the insurgency alive. After the May coup, Appas formally rose into the upper echelons of the intelligence services and quickly became one of the most influential officers in the army. In practice, this meant that the secret revolutionary societies waging unofficial wars across Serbia's borders, in Ottoman Macedonia and in Austrian-ruled Bosnia, now had deep institutional ties to the highest ranks of the Serbian military and intelligence apparatus. The two most important organizations within this web were Narodna Odbrana, National Defense, and Ujedinjenje ili Smrt, Unification or Death, better known as the Black Hand. Narodna Odbrana, or National Defense, was formed in 1908, immediately after Austria-Hungary's annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina. It was conceived as a national defense league, and its original founders consisted mostly of prominent cultural and civic figures, writers, professors, and retired officers. So, on the surface at least, the organization appeared more civic and cultural than paramilitary. But that appearance was deceptive. From the start, National Defense was virulently anti-Austrian and deeply committed to the project of Serbian national expansion. Its published program explicitly called for collecting arms, training volunteers, organizing guerrilla bands, and sending fighters across the border to, quote, liberate the Serbs living under Austrian and Ottoman rule. So even its civilian and academic wings were committed to armed struggle. In effect, it acted as a legal facade for a shadow army. Crucially, National Defense had extensive membership inside Bosnia, especially in Sarajevo. It became a hub of cross-border collaboration, linking Serbian nationalists in Belgrade with their counterparts living under Habsburg rule. Many of the young radicals in Bosnia who gravitated toward the student group Young Bosnia had personal or organizational ties to National Defense. Mladna Bosna, or Young Bosnia, was where Gavrilo Princip and his fellow conspirators first began their political lives. Long before they made contact with agents in Belgrade, they belonged to this loose constellation of student circles, reading clubs, and secret debating societies that sprang up across Bosnia after the Austrian annexation of 1908. Young Bosnia was not an official organization so much as like an atmosphere or a generational mood. Its roots stretched back to the long tradition of radical Serb politics in Bosnia, from the Herzegovina uprising of 1875 to the decades of resentment that followed Austrian occupation. But the events of the new century, the 1903 May coup in Belgrade and the shock of the 1908 full annexation, electrified young Bosnian Serbs, convincing many that their future could only be secured through unification with Serbia, or through the creation of a broader South Slav Yugoslav state. The core of Young Bosnia was made up of schoolboys and adolescents, often still in their teens, who devoured nationalist literature and passed banned books from hand to hand. Their ideological influences were eclectic and quite often contradictory. They read the Russian nihilists, socialists, and anarchists. They read conservative pan-Slavists like Fyodor Dostoevsky. They debated Nietzsche, Kropotkin, Bakunin, and Tolstoy. And layered on top of these European philosophies was the powerful emotional heritage of Serbian oral epic poetry. The tales of Prince Lazar, Miloš Obilić, and the martyrs of Kosovo. Stories that taught a generation to see politics through the lens of sacrifice, tragedy, and destiny. So, it was in Young Bosnia that Gavrilo Princip first absorbed these ideas. In the dim cafes and echoing schoolyards of Sarajevo, he encountered the literature and legends that first convinced him that killing a tyrant was more than a political act. It was a sacred obligation, an inheritance passed from martyr to martyr through which history itself might be set right. On June the 15th, 1910, a 24-year-old Serb from Herzegovina named Bogdan Zerajic attempted to assassinate the Austro-Hungarian governor of Bosnia on the opening day of the new Bosnian Diet in Sarajevo. Zerajic fired 5 shots at the governor but missed every one. And then with the 6th bullet, he turned the pistol on himself. Zerajic may have failed to kill the governor, but the attempt marked a major turning point, for this was the first time a young Bosnian Serb had attempted to turn the theory of tyrannicide into action. The authorities buried his body in an unmarked grave to prevent it from becoming a shrine, but it became one anyways. In the years that followed, students and radicals visited the grave in secret. In his later testimony, Gavrilo Princip said that it was at Zerajic's grave that he first vowed to kill, quote, an enemy of the people. For the boys of what would soon call itself Young Bosnia, Zerajic was not a failure, but a martyr, the first link in a chain they believed they were destined to complete. In 1912, carrying these ideas as his private gospel, Princip would leave Sarajevo for Belgrade. Officially, the 17-year-old hoped to continue his schooling, but what he truly sought was entry into the city he saw as the furnace of the Serbian national movement, and Belgrade would not disappoint. Upon arriving, he attempted to enlist in the Serbian army, only to be rejected as too small, too weak, and too sickly. The humiliation cut deeply. Disillusioned but not deterred, he drifted into the capital's radical cafes, where conspirators, officers, and students mingled freely, and where politics was spoken with the same intensity as poetry. Through sympathizers in national defense, Princip was eventually introduced to a man whose name every young nationalist in the city knew, Vojislav Tankosic. A veteran of the Macedonian guerrilla bands and a loyalist of APIS, Tankosic embodied the militant underground, a man who had murdered Queen Draga's brothers during the May coup and who carried an almost mythical reputation among impressionable schoolboys. Princip admired him instantly. Tankosic, however, dismissed the frail teenager. He approved of Princip's zeal, but he believed the boy was physically unfit for meaningful action. So Tankosic refused to take him into the army and kept him at arm's length. But fate would ultimately have other plans. For through Tankosic, Princip eventually crossed paths with Milan Siganovic, a Black Hand operative and railroad official who served as one of APIS's most trusted agents. Siganovic was far more receptive. He took Princip under his wing, trained him in pistol shooting, and crucially, became the conduit through which the boys of Young Bosnia would later receive their weapons. And so it was through this web of connections that Princip was drawn toward a newer and far darker force in Belgrade. Ujedinjenje ili smrt, unification or death, the clandestine society that history would remember as the Black Hand. The Black Hand was formally founded in 1911, just a year before Princip's arrival, by APIS, Tankosic, and several of the conspirators from the May coup of 1903. In truth, these officers had been conducting clandestine operations and cross-border raids for years, so the organization merely gave institutional shape to a network that had long operated in the shadows. From the outset, the Black Hand worked in close partnership with National Defense. Membership overlapped heavily, and the two organizations supported each other's missions, organizing guerrilla bands, smuggling arms, recruiting and training young militants, and circulating nationalist propaganda across Bosnia, Macedonia, and beyond. One of the clearest windows into their worldview was Piedmont, a journal closely associated with the Black Hand. Its title invoked Piedmont Sardinia, the Italian kingdom that had led the unification of Italy against Austrian rule. To the Black Hand's founders, Serbia was meant to play the same role in the Balkans, the vanguard state, the militant core, the, quote, Piedmont of the South Slavs. Belgrade, they believed, was destined to unite all Serbs, and ultimately all South Slavs, into a single national state. Much like Young Bosnia and National Defense, the Black Hand drew many of its recruits from idealistic schoolboys, many of whom were impoverished, fatherless, or adrift, and searching for meaning, belonging, and a cause worthy of sacrifice. Older officers provided the warmth, attention, and purpose these young men craved. The result was a cadre of fiercely loyal agents, willing to risk and often to give up their lives for the nation. In late March 1914, word spread through Belgrade that Archduke Franz Ferdinand planned to visit Sarajevo on June the 28th, Vidovdan, St. Vitus Day, the holiest date in the Serbian calendar when the martyrs of Kosovo were honored. The members of Young Bosnia reacted immediately. Some saw the visit as a deliberate insult, others as a sign of destiny. Gavrilo Princip and two of his closest comrades, Nedjeljko Kabrinovic and Trifko Grabež, resolved to cross back into Bosnia and kill the Archduke. They had long fantasized about martyrdom and tyrannicide, but this was their first concrete plan, a specific target on a sacred date. As Princip later said during his trial testimony, quote, "When I heard he was coming on Vidovdan, I decided at once to kill him." After forming their plan, the boys drifted through Belgrade's cafes and eventually approached Major Tankosic. Tankosic did not immediately commit, and instead he passed them again to Milan Ciganovic, a lower-ranking railway worker but a trusted clandestine agent already familiar with Princip. At this stage, the historical record becomes murky. Everyone involved later tried to obscure the chain of responsibility, but most historians agree that Ciganovic, a man closely linked with Apis, provided the boys with 4 Browning pistols, 6 bombs from the Serbian arsenal, and cyanide capsules. They were then instructed to kill themselves after the attack. All 3 accepted without hesitation, eager to follow Miloš Obilić and Bogdan Zerajić as the next martyrs in Serbia's nationalist canon. This sequence is revealing for 2 reasons. First, the assassination plot did not originate at the top of Serbia's intelligence apparatus. The initial impulse came from the young men themselves, who resolved to kill the Archduke and then sought help from those within the Black Hand network, who had the means to support them. Second, the events strongly suggest that Tankosic certainly knew about the plot, and that Apis also likely suspected what was underway, even if it remains unproven that he formally ordered it. The circumstantial evidence indicates that Apis probably chose not to interfere with a plan that aligned perfectly with his worldview and strategic aims. Historian Christopher Clark has also argued that even Prime Minister Nikola Pašić, the civilian rival of Apis and the Black Hand for control of Serbian policy, likely got wind of the plot through his informants and chose a posture of deliberate ambiguity. Pašić appears to have sent vague warnings toward Vienna about dangerous elements in Bosnia, but these warnings seem more like a covering maneuver, as Pašić never issued a clear, actionable alert that might have actually stopped the attempt. So, even though the assassination plan did not originate in the formal organs of the Serbian state, it is quite possible that the most powerful figures in Serbia's political, military, and intelligence circles either suspected or partially understood what was coming, and then failed to take decisive steps to prevent it. Whether out of tacit sympathy, strategic calculation, or fear of the domestic consequences of a crackdown, they allowed events to move forward. Now armed and instructed, Princip and his comrades were smuggled across the border through a covert network used for years by National Defense and Black Hand operatives moving guerrillas into and out of Bosnia and Ottoman Macedonia. Trusted couriers, teachers, and agents guided them by foot and cart toward Sarajevo. Once there, Princip, Kabrinovic, and Grabež met 4 other young Bosnia members who agreed to join the plot. In the days before the Archduke's arrival, some conspirators wavered, rumors of impending arrests circulated, and several argued they should withdraw. But where others faltered, Princip only hardened. He had come too far, and Vidovdan, he believed, did not offer second chances. And so, on the morning of June the 28th, 1914, the 6 young men took their positions along the Apple Quay, armed with pistols, bombs, and cyanide, and waited for the Imperial motorcade to pass. Chapter 3, The Day That Ended Peace. The lamps are going out all over Europe, and we shall not see them lit again in our lifetime. Sir Edward Grey, Foreign Secretary of Great Britain, July 1914. Interlude, the collision. The river ahead looked unnaturally still, as if the Milyaka had stopped moving. No breeze now, only heat pressing down, slowing the minutes to a crawl. The engine beneath him rattled, making the metals on his vest tremble against one another. Franz Ferdinand shifted uncomfortably, trying to keep his balance. He leaned toward Sophie. "My dear," he said quietly, taking her hand, "as soon as we visit the wounded, we will return to Vienna, I promise." She did not turn. He saw the faint tremor in her shoulders, the way her fingers tightened around her gloves. He spoke again, softer. "We must show them that we are not the enemy. The people of this city, they too are part of our empire." At last, she looked at him and forced a smile. A tear glimmered in her left eye before she turned away. Ahead, the lead car veered sharply to the right at the Latin Bridge. Franz blinked in confusion. "Are we not headed to the hospital?" Count Harek, gripping the running board, called across the car. "It seems they did not receive the message, Your Highness." The Count shouted to Governor Potiorek in the passenger seat, but the car lurched over the cobblestones, cutting his words short. The driver swung right to follow the others before realizing the mistake. Governor Potiorek grabbed the driver's shoulder and hastily yelled instructions. The car braked and then stalled. The Archduke turned, startled, as the motor sputtered and died. Ahead, the street was strangely quiet. His eye caught a thin young man standing near the curb, pale, still, watching. Franz felt a flicker of dread as he reached for Sophie's hand. Gavrilo Princip could not believe his eyes. He had been drifting along the riverbank in shock, convinced the day was lost, that the honor of martyrdom had slipped from him forever. He stood outside Schiller's Cafe, numb, when the sound of engines suddenly approached. The convertible rolled into view and stopped only a few paces in front of him. The Archduke sat upright, metals glinting in the sun. His white and red sash struck Princip like bone and blood. For a heartbeat, he remained frozen. Then the sound of bells hardened something inside him. Today was Vidovden. He thought of Obelich and Lazar. He thought of the oath taken at the grave of Zaraich. He thought of Kosovo. As he rose, officers shouted and the driver wrestled with the gears. But the car remained fixed. Princip stepped forward. Amidst the confusion, no one blocked him. No one even noticed him. He drew the Browning from his coat and the Archduke turned towards Sophie. Princip raised the pistol and fired twice. The Duchess gasped and collapsed into her husband's lap. The second bullet tore into Franz Ferdinand's neck. His hand snapped to his collar as blood soaked through his tunic. Princip lifted the vial to his mouth as hands seized him from behind. As he was being dragged to the ground, he heard the Archduke cry out, "Sophie, Sophie, don't die. Stay alive for the children." Princip bit down on the cyanide, but death eluded him. He gagged, vomited, and the crowd fell upon him in a wave of fists and fury. In the hours, days, and weeks that followed June the 28th, a crisis rippled outward from Schiller's Cafe, through Sarajevo, Belgrade, Vienna, Berlin, and St. Petersburg, like a shockwave. What had begun as a handful of gunshots became a frenzy of diplomacy, brinkmanship, and finally, open war. After the initial shock of the Archduke's assassination faded, Vienna turned immediately to the question of blame. It was quickly established that Princip and several of the conspirators were Bosnian Serbs, and that they had connections to underground nationalist networks in Belgrade. And even though the investigation had not produced conclusive evidence of direct involvement by the Serbian state, Austria-Hungary's leadership spent the week after the assassination debating how to respond. Their first move would not be investigative, but strategic. Vienna approached Berlin to ask whether Germany would support a punitive action against Serbia. On July the 5th, Kaiser Wilhelm II and Chancellor Beatmann Hollweg issued what became known as the blank check, a guarantee of German backing no matter how far Austria chose to go. Armed with this assurance, Vienna drafted an ultimatum designed to be rejected. It demanded that Serbia suppress anti-Austrian organizations, purge teachers and officers associated with nationalism, dismiss loyal civil servants, and, most provocatively, allow Austrian investigators to operate on Serbian soil. This last condition was a deliberate breach of sovereignty. It implied that Serbia was a rogue province, not a sovereign state. The man responsible for answering this ultimatum was Prime Minister Nikola Pašić. By 1914, Pašić had survived nearly four decades of Serbian politics, through coups, exiles, factions, and the conspiracies of men like Apis. He immediately understood the trap. If Serbia rejected the ultimatum outright, Austria would invade, and the army, exhausted from the Balkan Wars, would likely be crushed. If Serbia accepted every demand, he would be disgraced and quite possibly removed or even killed by nationalist officers at home. So Pašić chose the one path left to him. He accepted almost every condition of the ultimatum while refusing only the demand that allowed Austrian agents to conduct investigations inside Serbia. And critically, he then appealed to international arbitration, trying to move the crisis from the battlefield to the negotiating table. But Vienna refused to negotiate. Austria rejected the Serbian reply within minutes of reading it. There was no discussion, no mediation, no reconsideration. The decision to attack Serbia had already been made. And so, across Belgrade, church bells rang out. Crowds filled the streets singing epic ballads and shouting, "Long live Serbia!" The government mobilized the army and quietly sent feelers to Russia, which Pašić knew had already begun preparations of its own. And this was the moment when the world tipped over. Because when the Russians mobilized, first partially, then completely, it would send panic through Berlin. So when Austrian artillery began shelling Belgrade on July the 28th, it did not begin the localized Third Balkan War that Vienna and Berlin had anticipated. Instead, it began a European catastrophe. And within days, the great powers would all hurl themselves into the inferno. None of them understood it yet. But the shots in Sarajevo that had summoned the guns of Belgrade would soon carve the trenches of Flanders. So, the question then becomes, why did Vienna respond to the assassination with an impossible ultimatum and ultimately an invasion? And to answer that, we have to understand what the Habsburg Empire actually was going into the war. First off, Austria-Hungary was not a nation-state. It was a dynastic monarchy governing dozens of peoples, Czechs, Croats, Slovenes, Ukrainians, Italians, Poles, Hungarians, Bosniaks, Slovaks, Germans, each with their own language, traditions, resentments, and ambitions. The empire recognized 11 official languages. There was no shared national identity to bind them all together. Instead, legitimacy flowed from bureaucracy, law, the prestige of the Habsburg crown, and the promise of continuity. The empire survived not because its peoples loved one another, but because they accepted the monarchy as a neutral arbiter that prevented any one group from dominating all the others. To many within Vienna's governing class, this heterogeneous structure was not a flaw, but a mark of civilization. The belief that many peoples could coexist beneath one political roof, so long as they accepted order, hierarchy, and the rule of law. The system was slow, bureaucratic, and quite often inept. But for the imperial elite, that was the entire point. The empire existed precisely so that no single tribe had the right to rule the rest. And then the empire was also currently beginning the long process of reforming itself to adapt to the new challenges of the modernizing world. And at the turn of the century, the symbol of this modernizing empire, ironically, was the man killed in Sarajevo, Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Now, to be sure, the Archduke was not loved. He was dour, intolerant of court culture, and his marriage to Sophie was considered a humiliation to the dynasty. But Franz Ferdinand was a reformer. He believed the empire had to be remade if it was to survive. And his most controversial idea was what he dubbed trialism, transforming the dual monarchy of Austria and Hungary into a triple monarchy that would elevate the South Slavs to political equality. So yes, this meant Croats, Slovenes, Bosniaks, perhaps even Serbs inside the empire, would become a co-equal third pillar alongside Vienna and Budapest, a Slavic capital inside the imperial framework, not under a foreign king in Belgrade. It was an effort to inoculate the empire against the growing fever of nationalism. Because if Vienna could offer dignity, autonomy, and representation, perhaps its Slavic peoples would no longer demand independence. To Serbian nationalists, the idea of a triple monarchy was essentially viewed as sabotage. For if Vienna gave the South Slavs a homeland within the Habsburg system, then Serbia would lose its entire mission. Belgrade would cease to be the Piedmont of the South Slavs, the vanguard liberator. Instead, they would simply be another small Balkan state, watching its dream of unification die inside an imperial parliament. This is why radical Serbs identified Franz Ferdinand as a target. He was dangerous, not because he was cruel, but because he was conciliatory. Repression could be resisted, but reform seduces and neutralizes. It makes the revolution unnecessary and steals the myth of martyrdom. The result was two mutually exclusive visions for the future of the South Slavs. For Belgrade, nationalism meant redemption, the restoration of a broken people through sacrifice, struggle, and common destiny. For Vienna, nationalism meant destruction, an ideological pathogen that could tear the empire apart, community by community, until nothing remained. To the imperial elite in Vienna, nationalism was not simply a threat across their border. It was a growing infection within the heart of their empire. Because if Bosnian Serbs demanded their own nation, then why not Croats? Why not Czechs? Why not Slovaks? Why not Ukrainians? In short, what happens when all the constituent peoples of the empire insist on sovereignty? And well, what happens is that the empire ceases to exist. So this was Vienna's nightmare. And in June 1914, that nightmare suddenly arrived in the form of a small pistol fired by a sickly schoolboy on a sunlit street in Sarajevo. To the Habsburgs, the assassination of the Archduke was not simply a political crime. It was an attack on the very idea of Austria-Hungary. And because the empire's very foundations were imminently threatened, there was no room for debate. The threat had to be eliminated. Serbia had to be crushed. World War I did not begin as a struggle between nations. It began as a collision between two ways of imagining the world. On one side was empire, slow, bureaucratic, unromantic, but built on the belief that many peoples could live together under the discipline of law. It was fragile, yes, but it was also the last great experiment in plural politics before the age of ideology. On the other side was the nation. Young, ecstatic, impatient, built on sacrifice, memory, soil, and blood. It promised meaning to those whom empire offered only administration. It offered destiny where bureaucracy offered paperwork. A sickly teenager with a pistol did not topple Austria-Hungary, but he pierced the membrane that separated the old world from the new. Because after June the 28th, 1914, it was no longer enough to manage difference. One had to rule, convert, or destroy it. The war that followed was not simply a contest of armies. It was a test of ideas. By its end, Europe's greatest dynasties, the Romanovs, the Hohenzollerns, the Ottomans, and the Habsburgs, would all be gone, swept away in a fire of mutiny, revolution, and exhaustion. In their place stood a new century in which power would belong not to dynasties, but to movements. Nationalism, liberalism, socialism, fascism, communism, anarchism, Islamism. Not policies, not programs, but world-making visions. And so, the story of the 20th century is the story of these forces colliding, merging, and consuming one another. In factories, in trenches, in schools, in prisons, and on the killing fields of continents that had never heard the name Sarajevo. And that is the story that we will tell on ISM, how ideologies are forged, tested, and reborn in moments of great upheaval, how ideas become identities, how identities become causes, and how causes reshape the world. And we will begin that story where the modern left was first born. In Paris, 1793, in the streets of a city remade by revolution, where the fear of aristocracy gave way to the dream of equality, and where socialism and anarchism first began to take shape. You'll find the link to ISM and to the Substack with full notes and sources in the show notes. I really hope you will join me there. See you on the other side.
Tu penses sur les mousses sans goutte de sang.
ISM is written and produced by me, Matt Payne. The original musical score is composed by Ian Payne. Our theme song is performed by Aloe Vere on vocals and banjo, with accompaniment from Ian and myself. If you're curious how I build these narrative scenes, where I source the quotes, what lines are verbatim, altered, or composed to capture the essence of a moment, you'll find full transcripts, suggested readings, show notes, and behind-the-scenes looks at my process on the ISM Substack. The link is in the episode description. To learn more about Ian's work, you'll also find his website there. And if you'd like to reach out, you can email me at ismhistorypodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I will see you next time.